This is Doreen Howard. It's November 22nd, 2005. Today we will be interviewing Marilyn Coulter at UAW Local 602. Also present is
Cheryl McQuaid.
Marilyn, could you please state your name and spell your last name for the record and your address?
Marilyn, M-A-R-I-L-Y-N, Coulter, C-O-U-L-T-E-R. Address is P.O. Box 80334, Lansing, Michigan, 48908.
Okay. Have you always lived in Lansing, Marilyn?
Yes, I was born at Sparrow Hospital.
Are you married? Do you have any children?
I'm single, no children.
Okay. And do you have any extended education or military service?
No military service, some college.
Okay. I'd like to start out with your recollection of your first day of coming to Fisher Body. What is your seniority date? And explain your very first day coming into the plant.
Well, actually, I'd like to start back a little bit farther. Okay. I remember when I stood in line to hire in the plant. It was back in 1978. I graduated in 78, left high school, and came to the plant. And I remember my day, because the line seemed like it went from the front door, seemed like it all the way down Verlinden as far as you could see. It was a hot summer's day, and the bees were out chasing us, and there was some guy that was selling pop. And I ended up working right with Denise Van Alstyne, who was right in line with me. And we got in. I didn't get hired immediately because I was not yet 18. And I got the phone call to come in to work. And I went in, took the physical. And then they, you know, told me to report to work. And I came into work, and I started out on the day shift. And they had us in this little room. Then they took us out. And I saw this big, dirty building. And then I actually felt like a herd of cattle, because you just felt like a piece of meat, because you came through, and then different supervisors would come up to the group and pull, you know, people out as they needed them. And I still remember, I'm 5'10", and I still remember the supervisor, his name was Manuel Harada. He said, "Give me her because she's tall." Now, granted, at that time I was tall, but I didn't weigh squat. So he had me bolting. My very first job down was bolting down front seats. And I had to bolt down front seats, put on track covers, put in a trash can, put in a trunk lighter. And my utility person, who's the person who covers the jobs when you're absent, broke me in. His name was Ken, the laziest man I ever knew. Because he showed me that job and he just let me go. And I thought, this is insane to work that hard. And I was working and running and working and running. And, you know, everybody was kind of nice. And, you know, because there were no other women around where I was at. And but the men, you know, they were like, let me do my thing. So I did that. And I remember I didn't have a car. So I walked home. Because my grandmother didn't live too many blocks away from here. And I walked home, and I remember walking in, and I said, I don't believe people work like that. And parts of me hurt that I didn't know I had parts of. And I remember that day because I was so tired, and my body hurt so bad. When my mom was downstairs cooking dinner, I went up to take a bath, and she found me in a bathtub of water that was cold, and I was sound asleep. And I told her, I can't do this. And she said, sure you can. So I went back in. But it was a big fight because my father didn't want me to work in the plant anyways. So I did that for a few days, for about a week. And then Harada, his name was Manuel Harada, but he wanted people to call him Harada. He said, well, I just wanted to see if you could do it. I'm going to put you on an easier job. Okay. That easier job was on a curve. And working on the outside curve is harder. And it was called a C90 was the option I had to look for. And on that job, you had to put in the door handle covers, run a press, punch these square holes out, take that out, put another bracket in, and then stock both sides of the line, plus install that stuff. And I'm running and I'm working and I'm running and I'm working. And I still remember it was the first time the line stopped. And I saw smoke, and all I knew was it was a break. And I got to sit down, so I was enjoying it. It happened the first time, then it happened the third time, then it happened the second time. And her rider walks up to me and says, "How you doing?" I says, "I'm fine." I said, "I don't know where these little breaks are coming from, but I sure do appreciate them." And he says, "Well, you're burning up the cars." And what it was I was supposed to push door wires back and then run a screw, and I wasn't pushing the wires back far enough. And I was running the screw right through the wires, so when they went to go connect up to the power source, the doors were starting on fire. I burned up three doors. Ooh. So I thought I was in fear of getting fired. And they had initiations, and they were putting some of the young kids in trunks and letting them ride in the circuit over to the repair hole. And I'm claustrophobic, so I'm like, please, I'm going to lose my job if you put me in these trunks. So that didn't happen to me because it was a big playhouse. I couldn't believe, I had just got out of high school, and I couldn't believe how much they played. I mean, it was fun. Once you learned your job and stuff, it was cool. But, you know, I couldn't believe some of the stuff that they did. And they'd throw glove balls, and they'd hang tails on each other and have water fights and all that stuff. But I was working. I couldn't do that. And that was just insane. And I...
Could you explain what's a glove ball? What's a tail?
The tail is just plain and simple as they take strips of tape, because we use tape on everything. And they take strips of black tape, and maybe they'd put a tissue paper to it or whatever, and just walk behind you and stick it on your butt, and you'd have a tail. And that's what they did, and, you know, they'd get a kick out of seeing how long you could walk around without noticing you had a tail. So they did that. And a glove ball is that when I hired in, we had safety equipment. You had to wear glasses and gloves. Primarily, you wore gloves depending on what your job was. Gloves are optional. And they take the gloves and roll them up and then throw them like a ball. And that's what a glove ball was. And you might get popped in the head with one. Or else sometimes people had different little discs or something that might be part of stock or something that would be turned into a frisbee, and you might get punked in the head with one of those. Nothing that would hurt, but you see stuff flying every now and then. And or you get screws inside your gloves, which was always fun. And but it was a hard job. And I was in fear of losing my job after burning up the job. And Harada was a short man. He was Harada. He was a Hispanic man. And he was about, I'd say maybe about 5'4", maybe, if that tall. He was short. And he wore green glasses, they used them in the body shop for light. So they were dark green. And he'd come and he'd stand with his legs spread apart and his arms crossed, just staring at me. So I never left the plant. He followed me to my dreams because I thought I was going to get fired. And then along comes another man, and then here he is standing one day, just watching me and watching me and watching me, and I was scared. I'm like, oh my God, who is this person? And then all of a sudden, my supervisor walks down, and this man starts cussing up one side and down the other of him, because this was in the 70s, late 70s, and people still handled stuff the old hard way. And his name was Curly Jones, and come to find out, he was my committee man. And I still remember him saying, "What are you trying to do, kill this kid?" And I didn't know who he was, but he was my godsend because I had somebody to fight for me, and he got that work off my job. So I did that for a while, and there were a few other ladies that I worked with, but this job was pretty, you know, I was still kind of scared and real naive. I remember I took all my breaks on my job, and I would go to the bathroom and come right back. And I slept every chance I got because I was just exhausted from working that job. And I remember we had a 6-minute wagon. Wagon's a 6-minute break you got before lunch and after work. And after in the afternoon, and it was people from the cafeteria came with a metal cart and it had treats and goodies on them. And I didn't want the treats and goodies, but those 6 minutes, oh my God, that was 6 minutes I could sleep. So it was fine. And it got better after he got the work off my job. And then because I didn't have much seniority, I got bumped to night shift. And that was a whole nother world. Because, first of all, there were young people.
You started to talk a little bit about the wagon.
Mm-hmm.
What was the importance of the wagon other than, if that's something when I came in, it wasn't no longer in the contract. When was that taken away?
Oh, the wagon was taken away in early 80s. In the early 80s. Okay. And then it was just, and then that time was actually just roll over into wash up time, I believe. And it just went that way. And that way they didn't have to shut the line down. So they wouldn't be losing, you know, those 6 more minutes that they could go ahead and, because you got 6 minutes in the morning, 6 minutes in the afternoon. That's all it was. Okay. A little break. And 6 minutes doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're not working, 6 minutes makes a big difference. You can recover, you can run to the bathroom in 6 minutes. You know. And that's what it was, just a little break.
But so you were saying you went to the second shift.
I went to the second shift, and it was better.
What
it was,
job?
Oh, I did what was called cow panel extensions. And what that was it was right at the top of the hill going into 3X. And that was on the second level. And it was the first job coming up on the second level. And we put in, it was a piece of trim. I worked what was called soft trim, which was interior trim. And you put it on the door, right in the door hinge, where the hinge is, right by the dash. And you had to run a screw in the top of that and then just put the garnish moldings, which is just stuff to make it kind of pretty, tuck in the carpet and stuff. And I did that. But the only thing about it was, guess what? There were people that were my age and there were kids and we played music and everybody had a radio. We used to have radio awards. Some people had big radios. Some people had bigger radios and everybody had the same station and stereo sound. And you were young and we had a good time because we were kids and we were working and night shift and we weren't getting out of work till we were working 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, and we had a good time. But when I first went there, it was like, oh my God. The only bad part about it was I had just met everybody on day shift and got comfortable. And as soon as I got comfortable on day shift, I got bumped to nights, and boom, there I'm going to go. I don't know anybody anymore. So nobody knows me. I get broken in. And I'm getting to know the job. And it's hard working down the line with something like that because you were attached to an air hose. And I remember when I did that, I didn't know anybody. But that particular night, I was working for a man by the name of Gordy Hassler, who was like a nervous Nelly. And I broke 2 windshields, which also caused for the line to be stopped. It also caused for my supervisor to come down to me and tell me, he gave me 30 minutes to almost an hour off the line. And he said, I want you to get yourself together, but when you come back, we can't have this. You can't break down. You can't be breaking windshield and shit rolls downhill and you're at the bottom. So it was basically, get my act together, I was going to be fired. So, but needless to say, that night, walking out to the parking lot, everybody knew me. And so after that night, I was no longer a stranger to the people on the night shift. So that's what I did, working nights. But I did a lot of different jobs in the course of my 20-some-odd years of working there.
Doreen Howard, were you ever laid off during your time frame here?
Yeah. I was laid off a couple of times for various reasons. We had one time, I think it was during the oil embargo or whatever, we were laid off for a long time, and it was fine by me because we got unemployment and subpay. And subpay is something that helps supplement whatever you don't get in unemployment to help give you close to 95% of your pay. So it was fun for me because I was going to school and living at home, so it didn't really bother me when I was laid off for that. But I always did level back in. And that means that you'll take whatever job is available. And so nobody with more seniority than you can work in the plant. Less seniority than you can work in the plant if you're willing to do that job. So then I leveled into paint shop, and that was horrible because I sprayed paint. Because once again, being 5'10", people grab you for whatever. And I did door jams and deck lids, and I sprayed primer. And, you know, biggest thing with that is you don't want to have sags, but you had to wear protective clothing. You had to wear coveralls. You had to wear boots. You had to wear breathing apparatus with a filter in it so you look like a Martian, and you had to wear a bonnet on your head. Unless you had gray hair all day. And the floors were sticky and you were inside a booth, so you were isolated and you really couldn't talk and you really couldn't read because the stuff would end up with paint all over. So it was kind of boring. And you just spray the paint and just look forward to your breaks. And I hated it. And I remember saying, well, you can stay on days and work in here. I'm like, no way. I'm going back to trim. And that's what I did. And I ran back to trim. And I leveled off a couple of times. And I got in there again. And then another time I laid off was when they were adding the mezzanine to paint. And I remember I was doing pit fill then. And that was some putty that you had to spray on the seams and then scrape it off before it dried. And it was fine until they were rebuilding, and we had to get moved because we had pebbles falling on our head. And once again, the union came and saved us because our safety man made us move us a few feet. I didn't believe we had to have the union to come down to tell us to move us a few feet because we had pebbles falling on our head, but we did, and it worked. But then I went back to trim. When everything went back, I always went back to trim.
Doreen Howard, I wanted to take you back to something that you touched on earlier. When you came into trim, you had said that there was no other women in your area. I'd like to know, how were you treated as a woman, and how were you treated being a minority woman?
Initially, when I got around the corner, Vicki Britton was working around there, but for the most part, in trim, you know, I was 18. A lot of the other people were in their late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s. So it was fine. There were a couple of people who treated you like you were a piece of meat. And I can remember certain incidences that happened. And, you know, basically, you had certain people who would cross their bounds, but once you told them where you were coming from, they didn't bother you too much, except you get the cat calls, people woo-wooing baby and stuff like that. But it used to tickle me because sometimes I'd have on coveralls with a bandana on my head. You couldn't see anything. And then people were whooping and hollering like there are people stranded on a desert island and hadn't seen a woman in a million years. And you had that. But for the most part, guys treated you with respect if they knew that you weren't going to be taken that. You had some who tried to take liberties, but some of the guys, though, they took you under your wing, you know, and they let people know don't treat them like that. So the guys would come and stick up for you, but you learned not to go to sleep and not to bend over, because if you went to sleep, you might get your shoes tied together, and if you fell asleep, you might get if you bent over, you might get pinched or in the behind. They had a thing that they used to do that I had never seen before. Blew my mind. And that was called goosing. And the men were pinching other people in the behind. Men were pinching other men in the behind. I had never seen that in high school, but I did see it in Fisher Body. And they found out it was called goosing.
Cheryl McQuaid, when you said that when you hired in here, your father did not want you to work in a factory.
No.
But you hired in here anyway. Why did you hire in here, and did you have any other family that worked here?
Well, my step-grandfather worked up in paint, but he was in and out of here before I ever, and I actually knew he went to work, but they never talked about where they worked. My father worked in a foundry, but he never talked about it. It wasn't until later years I even found out that my father was a union rep. It was just something he didn't talk about. It was a factory life was not a life that he wanted for his girls. My other two sisters went to college. I was supposed to go to Western Michigan University. However, I came into Fisher Body University and got a whole nother type of education. And I remember the night. My dad didn't even know we had come to stand in line to get a job in here. And I still remember the night that I got hired in, and there was a big discussion, and that was probably one of the most uncomfortable dinners at my house, and it was one of the definitely the most loudest dinners because my dad was very adamant about me not coming in here. He did not want me in here. And I think that might have been because he was in a foundry and he didn't want factory life for his daughters. And later on with the physical problems that I've gotten from working in, I can understand that too. But I have no real regrets for coming in here.
But why did you come here?
I came in here because I was going to go to school. But I said I wanted to go ahead and take a year off first and make some money. And actually, I got in here and I started making money, and I was supposed to go in January the following year to Western, but I just never didn't. I never went. I got caught up, as they say.
When you hired in, was this plant called Fisher Body?
When I hired in, it was indeed called Fisher Body. And it was a coach, and, you know, they had Body by Fisher, and that's what it is. The name has changed, but, you know, if you say Lansing Car Assembly or BLC, people really don't know. They just say Fisher Body. They refer to it as Fisher Body.
Can you explain some of the changes within the plant that you've seen since it was Fisher Body to the day before it closed down? Supervisory changes, building changes.
Oh, yeah. When I first hired in, there was our facility had two plants in one. You had an A line and a B line. I hired in on the B line, which was the big car line, and the A line was the cutlass line. And they ran parallel to each other on both floors. And so it was two floors. And so one of the first changes was they took the big cars and kept them upstairs, and then they took the little cars and put them downstairs. And so you had upstairs and a downstairs, and there was A and B line, and then later became M and C line. So that was the line change. You saw chains being cut out. You saw paint shops being extended, and those are some of the physical changes they did. They went to putting on we have things called and-on cords that you could stop the line. So therefore, it made it a little bit easier so you could just stop sections of the line instead of the whole line being shut down, which was a job saver because if there was a problem in one line, you didn't lose a whole lot of line because the other line could keep on going and the other line could build up a bank and build up. So you had those. You had automation come in. We had a lot of robots come in the body shop. I never worked in the body shop, but there was a lot of robots that were placed in the body shop during our time here when they started the GMX 120 cars. And they put a lot of robots there. Naturally, we went from tag relief, which meaning a relief person would come and relieve you, to a mass relief where everybody would be taking reliefs at the same time. And that would be like body shop and paint shop and trim shop. They all had their own different start times. And so they would have mass reliefs. I believe body shop or, no, paint still had tag relief. But everybody else had mass relief where we shut down. And
did you notice any big difference between the tag relief to the mass relief? Were there any major problems with that whole system? Or
the biggest problem for me, being a woman, was when you have mass relief, there's less time in the bathroom because you have to spend more time in the bathroom because there weren't that many stalls. So that was the biggest problem. I mean, it was good in the sense that you could maybe sit down and visit with your friends, and everybody could sit down and take a break at the same time. But, you know, so there's goods and bads to each one. And and we went from having managers who came from the rank and file and moved up to contracts. That happened to contract supervisors. That happened like from 2000 on. And that was like you had somebody who came from the line, knew what it was about, knew what working in the factory was, to somebody who might have been a manager at Myers, who knew doodly squat about the line, and they were managers. And so that was a change that I didn't like. Not that I don't have any problem with working for kids, but, you know, it's hard to have somebody who doesn't know anything about something telling you what to do because they don't know anyways. A big change, one of the biggest positive things, and I was a part of a lot of those changes, were when they started some of the different programs where they had employee involvement, first one being QWL, the team build processes, EP, employee participation groups, and they had product development team representatives where they started letting hourly people get involved with the workings of the plant. And that was cool. I thought that was a big change, and it was a step in the right direction because, you know, if you do something 500 times a day, I think you pretty much know what you're talking about. And that was a good, smart stroke of business for General Motors to get employees involved in the process. And that's in suggestions. They had benefit reps. They had adaptive coordinators, which were people who placed injured workers. And, you know, these are people who came off the floor, and most of them knew what was going on. And then I did quality of work life, but one thing I did like was when they had product development representatives. Those came around in the 90s, and that's where they allowed hourly representatives to be liaisons between the engineers and the plant. And they had the same equal voice and say as all the engineers did. You did match checks. You did pilot builds. And you had a say on something to try to ward off things that would happen in the beginning. And I think that was some things that we had. We had, and through that project, we had guest assemblers. And I thought that was great because engineers would make things in theory. And then they'd come in and they'd do their job on the line. And sometimes they found out what they wanted to do on paper wasn't working on the line. You know, doing something in a controlled environment versus doing it on the line, whole nother story. So that was what was good about it. And then, you know, some people might say it started out with creature comforts, but, you know, a picnic table or a chair may not mean much to a manager, but to an hourly person, having a chair that you can sit down on for 5 minutes to get a break means a lot. So we did those types of things. And those are some of the changes that were good.
Did you, as an employee, ever participate in check pools, raffles, dinners?
Yeah. Check pool was where you played poker off your checks. And it was your last three and change. And my first paycheck, I remember the guys asked me, did I want to play poker to get in check pool? I'm like, no. Best check pool, a huge pot. Best check pool ever. I had four aces. And I didn't play it. Everybody wanted to, like, play my check because I had it. But I didn't play. And I did play after that, and I won a couple of times. You know, you win a few bucks. And we did that. And then we had raffles. Usually when we had raffles, we did it to help somebody. And if nobody knows anything else, General Motors, UAW employees, they always help. The benefit dinners for people. They've done raffled off quilts to help people. Members who may have had cancer or had their houses caught on fire, or I remember the first time I was ever out and I was sick, I got the hugest basket I'd ever seen in my life, and it came from my coworkers, and it just brought tears to my eyes when they came to my house, because I didn't think anybody really knew me that well or cared that much about me, and then I got this huge basket. I could not believe it. It was great. And when my father passed away, they took up a nice collection from me, and you know, really family. So, and we would do those kind of benefit dinners. And then we did dinners just because it was Friday or Saturday and we had to work. And I used to put a lot of those together. And that's where we'd all pitch in money for the meat. And everybody would bring, it'd be a potluck. And you brought your best thing or whatever. And for a while there, I lived right off Fast Food Highway. So it might be a thing where I'd pick up a bucket of chicken and everybody would bring something to pass. And we got through our day that way. And that was good. You know, and then sometimes people had little coffee shops and they'd have donuts in the morning. And Quality Dairy in Lansing had a place called, they had donuts called Grab and Go. So on Thursday, we'd take turns getting a Grab and Go box of donuts to have with our coffee in the morning. And it's just one of those types of things that help bring people closer together, and it does.
Doreen Howard, you talked about employees having coffee inside the plant. Was that something that was prevalent?
Prevalent and illegal, you might say, but it was one of those things where people had coffee pots, and we would, you know, some people had coffee pots, some people sold pop, some people sold little knickknacks, so it was close to the job, and they had their little stores going through. But primarily it was coffee, and coffee would be anywhere from a dime to 15, 20 cents, and the people who sold it at the end would probably do pizzas or donuts or something like that at the end. But it was, you know, just getting a good cup of coffee versus crappy vending machine coffee. And it was, you know, I remember when I hired in Fisher Body, I didn't drink coffee, and I just thought it was dirty water. And then I was like, give it to me intravenously, because you work in here all those hours and going to school, you start drinking coffee.
You said that it was against plant rules.
Yeah.
How did management take people having these small little businesses?
Periodically, they'd come through when people would get out of hand and shut them down. If they were getting too much beside themselves, they'd come through and shut them down if they caught them. But for the most part, you know, we did what we did. You know, you're in here before we went to 8-hour schedules, you're in here 9 hours a day, 6 days a week. Skilled trades people are in here 7 days a week. You do what you have to do to get by, you know, because 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, 2 Saturdays on, 1 off, that gets pretty monotonous, and you have to do what you got to do. And we were in here, and the supervisors were right in here with us. So.
And those supervisors probably
drank coffee too.
That good cup of coffee.
They drank the coffee too. They drank the coffee too. And I think that I would say that that's probably in any place of business, you know. And they still, the cafeteria people still laid up there too. So they just, you know, some people brought their lunch in, some people went out for lunch, some people, you know, bought stuff from the vending machines, you know.
Doreen Howard, how has the supervisory techniques changed from when you first started here till now?
Best thing I can say about supervisors, when I hired in, supervisors let you do your job. They knew you could do your job, and they let you do your job. We were called the capital of quality because we did good work. We worked together. Supervisor, you know, it was like an unwritten rule. You know, you take care of your supervisor, and your supervisor took care of you. I.e. meant you didn't send no crap down the line, and you got no crap from him, and he took care of you. And that was the biggest deal. They didn't try to babysit you if certain things happened. And I remember, you know, like I said, we were young. I still remember one person. We have a place across the street called Harry's. And, you know, people drank. Some people drank. Of course they did. In all jobs, they drank. But it was her birthday, and she didn't get to go home. So she had never had a drink in her life. And she drank Yukon Gold. And she came back, and she literally passed out. And we had cots downstairs in the bathroom, and us ladies went and put her in the bathroom. And our supervisor back then, he said, you guys did it to her. You covered her job. And no junk better not get down my job. Nobody got burned that day. It was her birthday. He couldn't let her go because we didn't have any extras. And, the guys covered a job. They got her hammered, meaning splottled. So they covered a job, and that's what we did. You know, we have team bill now, but we used to have team bill back then, too, in the sense that if you had to go to the bathroom and, the pickup guy was busy, we'd cover your job and let you go. You know, we work together. You know, we've always been a team, little pockets of little families in our own little community. Because Fisher Body is, when you have anywhere from 3,000 to 7,000 people working in a place, it becomes a community within itself.
Doreen Howard, can you explain some of the environmental changes that occurred during your course of employment here?
Environment in terms of the facility, yeah, the air, what? Yeah,
well, all that. You started to talk a little bit about some of the changes, and they made additions to the plant, mm-hmm. and things like that. How did that affect the internal environment? Was it cleaner? Was it brighter? Did they do things to
periodically they paint? But it was a factory. You know, it was lights and stuff like that. It's a factory, you know. Well, you know, they put a clean room in up at the paint department to keep dust and stuff off the paint. So you had to wear special lint-free clothing and stuff like that. But as far as trim, you know, as far as the environment, a lot of every now and then, I think I can remember them painting it once. And then they clean it. And what they would do is when we had model changeovers or Christmas holidays, they'd wash the walls. I did that. You know, I'd sign up to work those changeovers in. We'd seal floors and we'd wash walls, and it's not easy washing. Factory walls get very dirty, and you had to use some stuff called tack cloth and clean off it. And, you know, we clean it off and we spruce it up, stuff like that. They put in certain safety railings and stuff like that. to help people, those types of things that happen. And it was different. Yeah.
So in general, the trim department where you worked was a fairly clean department? As far as
I would say, you know, noise, you know, and there were certain
pollutants in the air.
There were certain pockets. One of the things that happened is we used to have noise increase with some things called balers. Balers is what they would put cardboard boxes in. And when they reduced out the sanitation department, the environmental services, they put balers in different areas in the plant, and they would break down the boxes. And they would put those boxes in the balers, and those were noisy. Because you used to have, you know, they used to come through, and the environmental services people, they'd sweep your area, and that was one of the changes. They made it later so employees were supposed to sweep their own general area in their own little teams and groups. You know, that was a change that they made. And that was noisy. That was one of the things that they made.
Doreen Howard, when you originally hired in, how did you clock in and out of the facility?
Well, when we first hired in, you used to have the old little punch cards. You had to wear a little badge that had your little employee number on it, but unfortunately I turned mine back in. And you have to just go in and that old little punch clock that they used to have in a lot of buildings. And later we went to a computerized system where you just had a card that you swiped and that little green light come on and make a little noise and said that you punched in or punched out. And that was it.
Cheryl McQuaid. Marilyn, if you were to pick your best memory of Fisher Body, what would it be?
My best memory, I have to say, I had a lot of memories. You know, working with the people in here, we had a good time. And when we used to work in nights, I remember sometimes the lights would go down. And they'd break down. And we had radios and we would dance. And, you know, we made the best of our time. And there wasn't any real best time. I think some of my best times happened was once I really got involved with the union. And when I got involved in some of the programs and it said I had a change. Oh, I take it back. One of my best times I was involved in a process. And in one of the programs we had downtime, I was a trainer for a while with downtime training, and that was some school. We had a Main Street school, and I was a teacher. And so here I was, 23 years old. It was 1987. And these people did not want to be there because they were laid off. It was summertime, and they had to come back in and take classes. And I taught the human resource and development part, you know, team building, how to get along, problem solving. And there was this one man, he was an older gentleman, brought a paper in every day. And we came to a part where people had to share their part. And back then, I was unfortunately a smoker. And I said, hey, let's take a break. Because he was getting really weird. So I went outside with him and I asked him, not to be offended, but could he read? And he said, no. And I said, that's okay, we can work with that. And so I read him his part. And he went back and was a, you know, active part in that class again. And it was great. One of the best days was when he came and told me that he did go back into his GED. And I have to say, that was the best part because I impacted somebody's life. And he was able to read now, and he went back and got a GED. And that was one of my happiest moments, I'd say, when he came and told me that he got his GED. And to know that you helped somebody. That was awesome. And then also when I had people who came back and said, well, from taking the communication classes, it helped them with their kids. That was awesome, too. I enjoyed when we had those classes. And that was another of those things where hourly people were able to teach other ones. That was cool. I like that. And let's see. And getting involved with the union, that was fun. You know, once you get impacting lives and changing things, because it's like when you say, so I was a civil rights chair in the union. And I remember when I hired in, there wasn't a whole lot of thing about sexual harassment and stuff like that. And I didn't know that I had those rights. I just knew I had to take care of myself. But when I found out that the union was there for me and I could have some impact on some of those things, so you didn't have to look at the dirty books, and because some men, they wore red dirty. I mean, it was part of life. It's not bad. It's not good. It just was so. You know, the whole country changed. And we had to change with it.
Doreen Howard, you said that you were the civil rights chair for the union. Mm-hmm. When did you get elected to that position?
Well, they had an election. At first, I was a member. I was a member of it. We were 3-year terms. Mm-hmm. And I did 2 stints on the committee. And then I think in the late 80s, early 90s, I became chair. And I did that right up until 2000. So all of my 90s, I was chair. All of the 90s, I was in chair. And part of the 80s. And it was good.
I'm interested in, as a woman's perspective with union involvement, how were you perceived when you went and went through the facility and talked with people and tell them that you're running for civil rights chair? How were you perceived by other fellow employees?
Given the fact that it was civil rights, you had to realize we had people here from all walks of life. You know, you had people who were good people, bad people, prejudiced people, non-prejudiced people. So it was like any other election. Some people, back then, when we first started out, you give a little card and you talk about people. I believe in talking to people, asking questions. You had some people who wouldn't even look at you. You had some people who would just take your card and throw it in the trash right in front of you. And then you had some people who go, oh, wow, we have this. That's what it does. You know, and they sat there, and the first time I remember, and then here again, you're a woman. And you have to think about it, on any given day, I could look to the left of me and the right of me and around for me and see nobody that looked like me, you know. I wasn't treated illy, but, you know, there was no comfort zone to look and say, oh, there's somebody with me. And I had the comfort zone of women, but as far as a person of color, no. And that makes for a long day, particularly when, you know, you had to learn to acquire taste for country music. But anyways, back to election. And so some people, they didn't even know about it, and they didn't know how it could be used. And so we went there. The first election that I went, I put in a good showing. 3 of us were running. And I remember the guy said, you're not going to win, you know. You're not going to. And I came in second, so I didn't feel bad about that. And I got some more time under my belt, and seniority is a big thing. And I got a little bit more seniority and went through again. I won by acclamation, actually. And then people got into the process, and just to try to, you know, get people to understand a little bit more about it.
As the civil rights chair, could you explain what that job entailed?
Yeah. In 1946, at our UAW National Constitutional Convention, they started what was called the Fair Practices Committee, which later became the Civil Rights Committee. And what they do is they go on fact-finding mission when a 6A grievance is involved. A 6A grievance is a discrimination grievance, or a sexual harassment type grievance, or some type of conflict. The Civil Rights Committee is considered to be one of the most special committees in the system. It is the only standing committee that has a right to be involved in a bargaining unit issue. We are not part of the bargaining unit. We work with the bargaining unit at the bargaining chair's request. And at that time, say, for example, if there was a sexual discrimination or sexual harassment, we go on a fact-finding mission to find out, investigating, and have hearings to see whether or not the complaint has merit. And then you let them know whether it does or not. And then it goes back to them. But you do the investigation for them. Sometimes, a lot of times, we just would, you know, primarily what you want to do is you want to get the, whatever the offense is, stopped. If it's a hostile work environment, if there's some kind of conflict, you want to get it resolved. Because you want the behavior to quit. It could be supervisor against employee or employee against employee. If it's an employee against employee, you do what you do a hearing, which is held right here at the Union Hall. And the civil rights chair is the highest presiding officer at that hearing. We also do equal application, where we sit down with members of management from the Labor Relations Department to talk about the environment, what types of things are going on. You might say, well, maybe we're getting a lot of complaints out of trim. Maybe somebody's hanging nooses in paint. And we would deal with those issues. And then we also try to have educational programs to get people to understand, like, what sexual harassment is, what discrimination is. And actually, one of the basics I tried to do is try to take the black face off of civil rights, because unfortunately a lot of people would think that that's what civil rights were, and so many people were covered under that umbrella. Particularly working here, a lot of us don't realize that the handicapper and the ADA, which is, Americans with Disability Act, a lot of us, because we get injured here, we later fall in place under that. But one of the most things that I was proud of as a civil rights person, chairperson, was we had equal application committee meetings with management personnel, and they were quarterly meetings. But one of the things that we started was we had housekeeping tours and safety tours. So what I started was I started an environmental civil rights tour. And what that would be was we would take random areas to see if supervisors were indeed enforcing the rules, meaning there weren't no girly pictures being hung up, there weren't offensive materials. And we would look for offensive materials, because I wanted supervisors to see offensive material the same way as they saw, notice screws on the floor or trash on the floor or safety items, so that we... Because sometimes, in some areas, you might have two or three women working in an area. They shouldn't have to look at a bunch of people. You know, because my motto was, if you want to look at your girly pictures, look at them at home. Don't do it in the shop. Because we wanted to make a comfortable work environment for everybody. And I understand, by and large, everybody was nice and respectful. But we even had men who were appreciative when I would do that, because we have a lot of people used to look at us as beer-drinking bowlers, but we had a lot of educated people on there. We had a lot of Christians on the line, and it's hard for a man to make a complaint about that, because then, you know, what are you, a girly boy? You know? So men would come and say, well, Marilyn, you know, they got this done, and I don't really appreciate that, because, we had plant tours with kids and stuff coming through, and it stopped. And I had supervisors saying, you know, Marilyn, is it okay? And they started looking at it, and they started taking stuff down. And that's what I wanted to accomplish with that, and they did. And it cleaned up the area, because... You know, back in the 70s, you know, before a lot of the laws started getting enforced, it wasn't pretty all the time in certain areas. You know, it was, you know, we were women coming into a man's world. And so I appreciated that. And like I say, most of the guys were like family, and they treated you really well. And like any place, just like a doctor's office, lawyer's office, or any other corporate office, sometimes people overstep their bounds. But this let them, you know, reinforce where their bounds were.
Doreen Howard, what is your most appreciated bargained benefit?
I'll tell you what. I really appreciate the every time I go to get my medications refilled or have a doctor's appointment, it's my health care benefits. But I'll tell you, I appreciate all that the UAW has done for not only me, but for the community. Because any place we are, the community does better also. And people often come off of us. The biggest problem, I think, with the union is that we failed to educate people on all that we did. So a lot of the people who came in young, they would think that, oh, it was generous motors. And it was things that were fought for at the bargaining table. And anything that we get at the bargaining table can be taken away with legislation. So anything that the UAW has done for us has been a good thing. And so I've only worked for General Motors, and so I've always belonged to the UAW, but I would never want to work any place where a union wasn't. That's it.
Doreen Howard, earlier I asked you about education. Did you use the tuition assistance program
most
to further
assuredly,
your education?
Most assuredly. And once again, another bargain benefit. And tuition assistance to help us, you know, if people want to advance themselves, UAWGM has made it available for them. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, rocket science or an engineering thing. You might want to learn how to do something that might be a hobby that will turn into something. Whatever. They even make it so if you want to go and go to a gym just to get physically fit, you can do that too. Those are some good things. We have so many talented people, educated people. A lot of times people don't realize the wealth of education that's on here. And, you know, General Motors has realized that, which is why they have a lot of these people now in non-traditional job assignments because, you know, the UAWGM has negotiated good paychecks and good benefits, and you have a lot of people who have full degrees, or maybe the field was filled, and so now they're able to put that to use here in the plant, and they have. Some of them have gone on to be managers, and some of them just have what's considered a non-traditional job assignment, i.e. they're not building cars, but they have something to do with the plant, and I think that's good. And we we kind of talked a little bit about vending. We have so many talented people. I know the rocking chair that I got for my nephew when he was a little boy was built by one of our members. He wasn't a skilled tradesperson. He was just somebody who knew how to do it. I've had dolls made by people who crocheted and they sold things. And God knows I think I've bought everything from everybody's child who's ever worked through here because you sell things for your kids. But they have so many different people who have so many different talents in here. Everything from jewelry making to wood burning to making dolls, whatever. And, you know, there's a lot of talent out there. And a lot of artists, too. We have artists. One of my fun memories, we had an employee by the name of Lyle Bertram. He's our citizenship and legislative chair now. But I remember Lyle playing his harmonica and his fiddle. Some of the guys sometimes at break times would come in and they would play their instruments and stuff like that. Like I say, things we did to get through the day. There's a lot of talent inside General Motors.
Cheryl McQuaid, did you ever have a skilled tradesperson do any kind of government jobs for you or do something for you to make your job easier?
Oh, sure I did. First of all, like I said, we had radios. And I didn't, back later on we got, some of the things that we had that changed in transition where we initially did not have lockers. We had coat racks, and if you wanted a toolbox to put something in, you had to get yourself. And I remember some carpenters made a toolbox for me that I could put my radio in, so I didn't have to carry my radio home every night. So I could put it in there. So that was one of my favorite things. Sometimes I might want a plug here or a plug there, because my whole thing was give me a radio and I can work all day for you. So I'd oftentimes have electricians give me plugs. That was my big thing. Or sometimes I might want a chair or something like that, or a fan moved, and I'd get that, you know, maybe have it done a little bit faster. But just those types of things. And I've had a few people who knew how to do things, you know, help me in my house a little bit.
Doreen Howard, you talked a little bit about people making things for you. It sounds like you had an awful lot of friends that you had made during your time here. Can you talk a little bit about the working family that you have?
Well, General Motors, we have a lot of things that we have. We had people, like I said, I grew up in Lansing. So a lot of people, I know people who came here. Some of my friends that I have here, I went to junior high with. A few of my friends I met while I've been here with, and we've done a couple of vacations. The person of whom I'm seeing currently right now is from, I met him here in the facility. And they're good people. And some people are like work friends, you know. You're together at work and you really don't see them outside, and there are a couple of people that you do. We also have, one thing about, we have a lot of different events. We have picnics. We have a union picnic, and then we also have baseball teams and golf outings and stuff like that. But I was on the bowling team. I played on UAW Local 602's, both their night and their day shift bowling teams. And When I did the day shift bowling team, and we bowled at night, we were called, and then there were us, because initially it was just a bunch of men, and we were a team of women, and we got on there. And so you develop friendships or strong acquaintances from that, and it's good. And those are some of the things that that we did. I didn't do a lot of stuff. I did vacation with a couple of people from the plant, and that's, you know, and some people are like family. I mean, they take vacations together, they camp together, they have yearly trips that they take.
Cheryl McQuaid, Marilyn, can you tell me what was a typical lunch for you when you hired in, and maybe even how it progressed? Some people had Bible studies, some people went to the bar.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had some people, it was amazing, and unfortunately it was part of the culture. We're talking about the culture. There was a bar at every door. Now, you had some people who, we also lived off, we worked on off Saginaw, and down Saginaw you had McDonald's and Burger King and KFC and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and then you had all that. So you had some people who would work up the line to run and go down there. And then we also had people who would work up the line to either go to the Shop Stop, which was off the paint department door, or to the Irish Pub, which was on Saginaw, or to Harry's, which they sold food and they also sold spirits. You know, some people go over there, have them a beer or two at lunch, and then or three, and then come on back into work. And that's what they did. And so for me, sometimes I'd bring my lunch in and study because I was going to school. Sometimes I would bring my lunch in, or actually one of my friends, she used to love to cook. So she used to bring in lunch, and we'd sit down, and we might play cards. Usually people either play euchre or bidwiz, which is a form of euchre. And we'd play those card games at lunchtime, and that's what we did. So you had some people who did that. Some people crocheted, and that's what they did. A lot of people do crossword puzzles. A lot of crossword puzzles, a lot of newspapers. Some people just read. And then you have some people who just run over to the bar, get a hamburger and some spirits, and then they come back. You know, some people sleep. You know, I remember one time I used to climb in bins and I'd sleep at lunchtime. So it depended. People did a lot of different things. And sometimes people partied inside too. So it was good. And that was one of the changes. You had asked me about the changes. One of the big changes was in the 70s when we hired in right up to the 2000s, you could smoke in the plant. And a big change happened when they had a city ordinance happen where you could no longer smoke inside facilities. And the plant was one of them. And it was weird because you used to be able to just fire up right on your job. And, you know, but then now you had to walk outside or go to a designated area. But I have to tell this funny story. It's a funny story about smoking. I had a job that I was put on dander patches, and my friend was smoking a cigarette. And she smoked a cigarette, and she lit it, and then she shook the match and tossed it. And I'm talking to her, and I'm working the line. All of a sudden, I stop, and I look at her, and this blaze is coming up behind her head when she set the trash can on fire. So, you know, she came back with, I said, oh, we need water. She came back with a small coffee cup. You know, it wasn't even a coffee mug, a very, very small, small cup of water, and put it in the water. And, you know, the guys came through and they put it out. And then she went back to her job. But we have, like, in-plant firemen and stuff like that. So when something like that happens, you get all these white shirts with your supervisors, and you get the safety department coming down. And she had gone back to her job, and I had to deal with her mess on my job. So that was funny that night. I told her, you can't smoke on my job because you don't know how to handle your matches.
Cheryl McQuaid. Marilyn, I've worked with you for a number of years. Yes. And you had mentioned that sometimes you sleep on lunches. And I know you have a funny story about one time when you fell asleep on a lunch in a stock.
Oh! Oh, yes. People pull practical jokes. And you get through, and there's this guy named Claire. And he had been going on all over. Because, you know, you stand at a bench, he was grabbing my legs and stuff all day. But I was also going round and round with my stock man about my stock. I was putting on something called stock moldings, scalp moldings. And my scalp moldings came in a box that might have been, well, maybe 5 foot by 2, or something like that. Now, they were small boxes. But Claire's like 6'2". So I went to lunch and I came back and there was a box of stock in front of my desk. And I'm fussing because going, oh, what did Jerry put this here for? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Doesn't dawn on me that there's black tape on this box. So I figure, forget it. I'm just going to go ahead and put the stock up on my rack. And I go to pull the tape up and this man jumps out of this box at me. And I'm like, how did you get your butt? I mean, I must have jumped 20 feet and I laughed. I'm sure I laughed as hard as anybody else because I could not believe he jumped out at me out of that box. And I'm wondering, how did you get yourself in it? Who taped you up in it? So there were a couple of people who were in on it. And it was funny, though. I had to laugh. And the worst thing you can do in the plant is for people to know that you're jumpy, which I am. And once you become jumpy, you can believe you're going to get at least 2 to 3 scares a day, which I did. And that was my best scare, though. That was my absolute best scare because he jumped out of a box at me. Another one would be, unfortunately, they would do things to rodents. Little mice, and they would tape them certain places. So if they knew you had a thing about mice, you would you might open a locker or get in a car and see a dead mouse taped to the interior of a car. And they were all over. I remember Joyce, there was one funny story, and I'm sure she didn't think it was funny, but a woman by the name of Joyce Robinson, she had rubber bands all the ways around the bottom of her pants. And I asked her, Joyce, why you got your rubber bands on the pants? And because of mouse, they ran up her pants leg. And so, you know. But it was a factory, you know. We had trains coming in and out, and we had mice in here. But we also had cats, wild cats that were in here, and people would feed them. But they were part of it. And birds and everything else, you know. So inside the plant, we had a lot of things other than cars in here.
I want to remind you of another memory you told me about years ago. And that was probably in 1979, 1980. GM had a major power outage. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was interesting. We had a blackout, and it was funny. It was I had a car back then. It was an old blue Impala. It didn't have a light in it, so I had a flashlight. And I remember the lights went out, and the supervisor had to use me to help pass out checks that night, because if you work second shift, you got paid on Thursday night. And there wasn't any lights in the bathroom, so women wanted to get escorted down to the bathroom because naturally guys are pulling jokes and pranks. And the air absolutely reeked. So those people who were smoking things other than cigarettes were definitely smoking. But it was a good time, and we had the lights out for a while, and then finally they decided to send us home. And the lights came on just as we were going, just as we were leaving, and then we just all walked a little bit faster. And then the second blackout happened when Major, in 2000 era, and not only Lansing, but quite a bit of the Midwest got blackout. And I saw the lights flicker. And I thought, and it immediately came back to my mind, they flickered again. I went and grabbed my purse. I started heading for the door. And well, I just got halfway to the door. The lights went out, and people said, how did you know? I said, you've been through it once. You should know. And that happened. That was
Doreen Howard. Have you participated in any types of community activities?
Mm-hmm. I am union active. I'm an active member now, past president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. And it's an organization built up of women of different labor unions to help empower women and to educate them. I'm a president now, an active member of A. Philip Randolph Institute, which once again is a labor-based organization of different unions. We educate and do voter registration and voter education. And once again, try to get people involved in the labor process, and we support labor activities. All these are nonpartisan groups, and I'm also an executive committee member of the NAACP. A lot of people don't understand that the UAW and the NAACP go hand in hand with labor and the freedom fight, and they don't really understand how instrumental Walter Reuther, who was, if not one of the most influential presidents of the UAW, had impact with doing that. It was Walter Reuther who helped to get Martin Luther King out of the Birmingham jail. And we've always been active in those movements because the same people who are against labor are the same people who are against, you know, civil rights. And so those types of groups. And women's rights. You know, a woman's place is in her union and any other place she chooses to be. So those, helping people, that's what I do.
With the plant closing, and you're one of the few people that saw the very final days here at the plant, can you describe the feelings that you had when you walked around the facility and the closing of it?
You know, before I had said I had worked changeovers, so I was used to the place being sparsely populated or darn near vacant, but you used to see construction workers coming in. And as you walk through certain parts of the plant, you know, it's always good. It's good to know that we have something new coming. But you walk through and you see memories and you walk certain places and you remember things that happened, and it's going to be weird not knowing that you were here because this big green building has been here all my life. And, you know, so it's going to be weird not coming in here. It's great that we have a wonderful place to go to. I mean, we're very fortunate at a time when General Motors is closing a lot of facilities. But it's, you know, it's mixed when you look at the emotions when, you know, Sexton High School is right down the street and the kids who work there can't even have a dream of coming in here. Because some of them, you know, they know they want to get there. And there's a good job there, good pay. So it's sad. You know, it's bittersweet. It's bittersweet. It's exciting to know we have a new place to go. And, you know, and it's kind of nice to know that you're going to be, you know, you stop and think about it. We'll all be historians in the sense that we were there when this door closed and we're going to be there when those doors open. So, but it's kind of sad, though, because, you know, 27 plus years of my life has been in that place. And technically speaking, I grew up in there because I turned 18 in August and hired in there in September. So I've been there all my adult life and seen a lot of changes, good things and bad. The worst thing I ever seen there was we had a fatality. And we had a construction worker and he got his head caught in a chain. And we have an ERT team, which is emergency response team. They did all that they could do. They responded very quickly. But when you sit there and see another person dangling in the air with their head crushed, and you see that, and we have UAWGM, great job, because I think that they're now called work family reps. At that time they were called EAPs, Employee Assistance Program people, and they help people, and they brought people in to talk to people to deal with that situation, and you can still go down there afterwards, because once you see something like that in the plant, you don't forget it immediately, and you sleep with it, and you wake up with it, and so those are things, so you take those memories with you right along with the good things. Like I said, the water fights, the hard working, the different changeover, the model changes, the crazy jobs. You know, you unfortunately, you know, one of the other programs we have is Shelter Workshop, because I'm in that also. And that's where you've worked, and it might be because I did regulators, which is the thing that makes the windows go up and down, bolting down seats with torque guns, all those different things, and then just walking on, you know, we have ergonomic matting now, but before you just walked on cement floor all day. And now, so you have to get in the sheltered workshop, which is where you try to get some work that's in line with your restrictions that you can do so that you can feel good. Unfortunately, sometimes you can work because people want to work. It's just they don't want to hurt anymore. And sometimes you get treated like a second-class citizen. But it's nice that they do have the sheltered workshop to try to place you in to do things that you can do. Unfortunately, we have a lot of jobs outsourced now, so some of those jobs that were easier for us to do have been outsourced to other companies. You know, environmental services, door build-up, things like that have been outsourced, and that stuff comes in already done now. Some outsourcing is good. Robots, people didn't need to be doing them anyways because they got hurt too. And but you know, the shelter's there for us too. Because that's the only downside about working in the factory. Sometimes the physical requirements, you know, working that line and moving motors and stuff. We have ergonomic tools and stuff now. Those things have evolved and made it better, but sometimes it's still rough on the body.
Cheryl McQuaid, Marilyn, is there anything that you'd like to share with us that we've not asked you?
Can't think of any. I really can't right now.
Well, we really appreciate this time mm-hmm. that you've spent with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.